Okay, there's the brown again, and where you left off, you were saying something about...
I still have an affinity for Asians. I entertained a house guest for about a month, about 5 years ago, 1991. We had a house guest from Shanghai, who was a exchange professor. So my wife and I decided to be host for him. And I've had a number of students from Japan who were here to get their degree, you know, become friends with some of them.
Yeah.
And I like Asian society. I enjoyed my travels after I left Vietnam. I went all throughout Asia. And I regret the fact that I didn't stay 2 years. And under the circumstances, I had legitimate reasons to leave Vietnam, but I'm sorry that maybe I didn't get there a year and a half earlier.
that you spent that year in graduate school rather than going straight into it. Of course, you didn't know about IBS, so you can't really...
No, I didn't know about IBS, but just once I got there, I enjoyed the teaching except for implications of what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah. Good students, but look what it's being used for.
Yeah, and that really disturbed me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other thing that you mentioned, if I wanted to follow up on, was the race thing, and you did mention that, and you mentioned how you yourself were instrumental in breaking down stereotypes.
Well, the thing about Vietnam, and you don't see it on the surface so much.
Mm-hmm. And I should say that I saw a lot of this sort of from the other side in the Philippines, where... You know, they were clearly making references towards whiteness as being better, that I found even being white as being offensive.
Well, that was true in Vietnam, and I got this from my language instructor, and I got it from the Vietnamese who worked for IBS.
Mm-hmm.
And we have candid conversations, and they would tell me, you know, you're white, you're number one, if you're black, you're number 10.
Mm.
And I saw it firsthand. I went to an orphanage a few miles from where I was living. My parents would send these packages, and some of their neighbors would contribute, and they would send like diapers and things for the children.
Mm-hmm.
And I would take it to the orphanage, and in the orphanage there were children who were mixed race, half Vietnamese, half black,
right.
and half white and half Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And I was told that the half black ones would never amount to anything. The girls would be prostitutes, or and the boys would be street boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't have any kind of opportunities in Vietnam because of the racism. I could see this even the Cambodians. Cambodians, generally speaking, were darker. And you would
see... Well, they're Malay rather than mixed with Chinese. Know, so.
And then you would see a lot of Vietnamese would go to extremes not to have exposure to the sun.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure it wasn't fear of radiation. They were
It wasn't UV rays.
Carry parasols, and then they had these large hats that they would wear, and the high button collars and long sleeve shirts, because of the premium of being fair complexion. Mm-hmm. And so these kind of things that you would notice. But I would come in contact with Vietnamese, and on a personal level, wouldn't have any problems. The same thing is true of Japanese. I talked to some of my Japanese students, and they would tell me about the typical stereotypes that Japanese held towards African people. But you don't necessarily see it. They don't display it, but they may think it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a student who told me that, in fact, she became a minor in black studies at the college.
This is a Japanese student?
Yeah, student okay. who came over. One time we had a campus in Hiroshima.
Mm.
That closed down, but the college felt an obligation to bring students over to finish up their degrees, and so she was here, I think, for 2 years, and decided to be a minor in black studies after taking some classes. And we had some number of conversations where she would just tell me about stereotypes that Japanese held, and but they wouldn't express it openly, but they thought these things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You mentioned the race thing in a couple of different places. And in one of the places you said that they've been pretty much brainwashed into the preference for whiteness over darkness. And I was wondering where you think that
I came
that
from
brain
French,
was
from French.
From the French.
Yeah, from being colonized.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure those who spoke French were considered more elite, more elevated than those who couldn't speak the language. And I mean, the fact that just from my experience of seeing children who were half European, they were more privileged in the eyes of the Vietnamese than children who are half African.
Yeah.
And just those observations. Such a long time ago. I mean, on a personal level, I never had any problems. Like, people didn't... Well, sometimes the kids would make fun of you, but I think that was just kids behaving that way. I mean, they were, to me, obnoxious because they got away from the traditional values. They said, like, you know, and point your finger. Number 10. But I never had any, like, overt hostility shown towards me.
Yeah.
I mean, some things that I experienced, I thought it was more because I was an American than the fact of my complexion. For example, if there was a young woman who was, I'm not sure her job was, she was at the AID compound. Mm-hmm. I go and pick up my mail.
Yeah.
I guess it's like a, not a security guard, but you go through and she signs your name. And she's in a little cubicle just before you went to the AID compound.
Yeah, kind of like security slash sort of like receptionist.
Reception. But she obviously wasn't, she couldn't stop anybody physically. But
yeah.
No, I would talk to her in Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I bought her some cigarettes one time in the PX because I noticed that she smokes. I actually bought them for Ted for holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Carton of cigarettes. You know, I didn't smoke myself, but I would say a few words to her. You know, she's always seemed friendly. One day I saw her in the street and like stone face, you know, straight eyes straight ahead, like no acknowledgement. And I didn't say anything, but I realized her situation where she might have been ridiculed by Vietnamese, you know, working with those Americans, you know, our enemy or whatever they thought of Americans. And so it's to her advantage.
Or just those Pharaoh.
Yeah.
You know.
So it's probably to her advantage not to acknowledge knowing American. So I didn't consider that a racial, I just considered that a national thing where her reaction was to me as an American.
Yeah, protecting herself socially.
Yeah.
In that sense, from any
I'm sure American. People like her probably had a lot of problems because after the war ended, I'm sure they still had a lot of problems.
Yeah, very likely. Did you ever think about going back?
No. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I do, but the same in Ethiopia. I have this feeling like I saw it and I experienced it, and if I go back, it's going to be different, and I might not like the contrast. So my memories tell me what I like, and my eyes might tell me, well, it's different now. It's not the same. So I just prefer to keep my memories. I like photographs. You know, these mm-hmm. are some of my travels.
Oh, okay. I hadn't looked around the room.
Yeah,
but now
those three that are Ethiopia.
Looks like a Khmer temple.
It's Kashmir, and it's Thailand,
mm-hmm.
Nepal, and it's Cambodia there.
Yeah.
Nepal. And that's some more upstairs. But,
it seems like every former volunteer's house always has got some sort of mementos somewhere. You know, some a little bit more than others, but everyone's got something somewhere around the house.
But I found, too, that a lot of people like Americans. There was a young lady who lived next door to me, mm-hmm. and I was informally teaching her and her brother some English. And one day she kidnapped me. She wanted me to go somewhere with her, and she was trying to tell me in Vietnamese. And so I had a bicycle, and I was following her through all these little maze-like streets, alleyways. And he took me to the home of her friend, and all she wanted to show me was a photograph of her friend, an American. A friend had married an American, and mm-hmm. now I was living in California. And I took that as a signal that she wanted me to take her to America. You know, she was like about 17 or 18.
There might have been some hint there.
Yeah, that was my thought. Somehow she was trying to tell me that she wanted me to take her to America.
She might be receptive to some sort of offer.
Yeah. Come on. But that was that kind of thing. And then one day I was walking through somewhere in the town, and I think it was raining. I kind of stepped close to a building, and this man did like this, and I was kind of hesitant. He did like this. I walk into his doorway.
This kind of a come on thing.
Yeah, like come, you know, like come, you know, like come, you know.
Okay, because you're making the hand signal like over. I'm used to the under.
Well, in Ethiopia they do it like this.
Yeah.
Just come.
Yeah. Making the hand signal going downward.
Yeah. He's doing something like this.
Okay, like more like we would do.
Yeah, and I was hesitant, but I came in and he pulled out his Vietnamese English dictionary. He wanted me to teach him English.
Right then and there. Classroom on the street.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was curious about the perspective that you had on race, because and it does cross over with foreign nationality, mm-hmm. and the context of the war, and how distinctions can be made. And, well, it is a very complex.
Yeah, thing. I mean, no, historically, some Vietnamese didn't like African people because of the Africans who were in the French army. And I heard some stories on the involving atrocities or rapes or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's some bad feelings going back to the 50s. Sure, but then I mean in Vietnam in the war zone, a lot of barriers are broken down.
Mm-hmm.
You got GIs living with and marrying Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
so those barriers are broken. And, I never had any personal offense.
Right. Yeah.
I meet people. It's just that talking to Vietnamese who I knew, and they would be Canon. They would just say, "Well, white's number one, black number 10."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "What does that mean?" And they said, "Well, white good, black bad, worse."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're very casual and very candid in their expressions.
Yeah, I was thinking when you talked about the children that were born and were probably abandoned by the GI father. Same sort of thing would happen in the Philippines.
I don't think they probably didn't even know they had children. I mean,
They knew or not.
But I mean, just in the orphanage,
mm-hmm.
there was just a lot you can tell, the complexions and the hair, you could tell they were mixed. My students, I didn't have any problems with my students except once, and it was cultural,
mm-hmm.
That's the term. I had a bicycle. And I parked the bike outside the classroom. And the classes didn't have any windows. I mean, they had the shutters, wooden shutters you could close, but they didn't have any glass windows. And when class ended, I'm getting my bike, and all these kids would surround me, like holding to the steering wheel, like pulling on the seat.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, go away, no, find if I can get out. And I never knew why they did that, but the only thing I could think of was that they were ridiculing me in their way because I was riding a bicycle. And I'm a teacher and I should be riding something more luxurious.
At least a motorcycle.
So I ended up buying a motor scooter.
Uh-huh.
A motor scooter, we call it a Lambretta or something. A little, mm-hmm. little small thing, goes about 40 miles an hour. I remember buying one from an American civilian. And after I bought that thing, I never had any problems with the students. Trying to pull when I was leaving.
Well, maybe they knew that the engine would drag them along.
No, I just think, I really think it was something, in their own way, they were saying to me, you're better than we are, so why are you riding a bicycle?
Yeah, why are you just doing this?
Yeah, you're educated, why are you riding a bicycle?
Hmm.
That was my impression, because I couldn't think of anything else to explain that. It was like teasing, it wasn't malicious, but it was still teasing.
Mm-hmm.
Because students would basically respect me. In the classroom, they're very respectful.
Sure.
The sir, and they uh-huh. stand up when you walk into the classroom and do those things that you never see here. But at my very least of the day, they would let me leave. They pull on my bike. And they'd kick at them, go away, let me get out of here.
And it wasn't that they wanted more class instruction.
No, it's just, I think they probably couldn't tell me in English, but that's my sentiments, that they were somehow saying to me, you deserve better, so why are you acting like this?
Yeah, there is some layering there that's deeper than the surface. There was one thing that you said, and I don't know if I can pick it out, but I think you were saying at one point that there were some, that you thought there were volunteer feelings of empathy or approval of of the Viet Cong positions.
Yeah, I
think, is that a fair interpretation?
Yeah, I think it's probably a romantic view, though. I think a lot, because we saw the corruption.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Vietnamese who didn't want to go in the military. I had Vietnamese teacher friends who weren't doing anything good.
Mm-hmm.
They asked me how could they get to America, you know, those kinds of things. Who didn't want to go in the military. We all knew that the Vietnamese army wasn't gallant. They didn't seem to be that courageous when they went off to battle, that Americans were taking up more and more of the brunt of the war. And what we can understand that the Viet Cong were doing land reforms, you know, trying to weed out corruption. So I think we had a romantic view of the Viet Cong. So in that sense, I think there was a lot of sympathy for the Viet Cong position.
At least for their potential.
Yeah, for the potential. And, it's almost like, you know, Castro in 1960. Here's a change, a transformation. But I know this Vietnamese fellow, I received a couple of letters. I can't find my folder. I have a folder in IVS with some correspondence. I had corresponded with Balaban before we reunited in 91. And I wrote some things and when I was in Vietnam that I kept. And I cannot locate that folder. I was going to make some copies, and when I find out, I'll send them to you.
Okay.
But this Vietnamese fellow who wrote to me just recently, about a year ago, just saying how hard it was after the war ended, because he had to go through that re-education.
Oh, okay.
You know, he worked with Americans.
Because he worked with you?
Yeah.
Yeah. With you or with other Americans?
Well, he worked at IVS.
He worked with IVS.
Okay. IVS in Canto.
Uh-huh.
So we all knew him, because he would be around, he'd be, you know, drive around for us, or interpret for us. And we had you know, basically, he's with Roger Montgomery Moore, but we would see him at least two or three times a week, you know, on IBS stuff. And he was just saying how hard it was. In fact, I remember writing to him, and I asked him, I said, well, you know, a lot of articles appear in the New York Times on Vietnam. Okay, if I send them to you? And he said, no. They don't send me anything on Vietnam, because he sort of said between the lines, and that would be wise, because how people might interpret what he's getting.
Right.
But, I mean, he was able to write new letters, and basically was trying to get with me sponsoring him.
Yeah.
You know, I said, I can't sponsor you, because I'm not in that position. And, he wanted names and some IBSers, and a lot of money, didn't know where they were. So I suggested he write to IBS in Washington. And Balaban said he's written to him also.
Who was this fellow?
I think his name was Phuong, or I can't think of his name, but I have the letters. I just got to find the folder, because I have a filing cabinet upstairs, and I took stuff out and I put them in boxes.
Ah, yes.
And I was
I'm familiar with that.
I was trying to find things before you came, and it's not my filing cabinet, and I couldn't find the boxes, so maybe he's stuck somewhere.
Well, I have to send you that signed consent form anyway, so
I'll find out. I'll go through those boxes, because I thought I had it in the file cabinet, and I took everything out of the filing cabinet. I had all these folders labeled. I couldn't find it, because there were some interesting things. Because when I was there, I wrote about six letters that IVS reprinted and sent out to friends and family.
Yeah.
And just my impressions. And I talked about the Tet Offensive.
Yeah, those are invaluable. So.
And I gave some statistics from what I recall from the Stars and Stripes or the Christian Science Monitor that I was subscribing to at that time.
Mm-hmm. Let's sort of get back on track in a little, in a sense. Because you mentioned that you went to Cambodia. Did you also go to Laos on your way back?
No. What happened was, when we went to Vietnam, I guess out of Washington, they gave us our tickets. We were told there was a rider that we could go to Singapore for something like, I don't know, $30. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we put it on.
Yeah.
So when I left Vietnam, I went right down to Singapore,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't like that well. To me, it was just too clean and too British.
I had the same impression.
And then I went to Malacca.
Uh-huh. How'd you like that?
I liked that. And I went to Kuala Lumpur.
Mm-hmm.
And went to Penang.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a train to Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
And from Bangkok, I went to Cambodia. Because at that time, you could go from Thailand, let me see, you could fly from Bangkok to Cambodia, but for some reason you couldn't fly from Cambodia to Thailand. I forgot the reason, some border stuff.
Yeah.
So I went to Cambodia, went to Angkor Wat,
uh-huh.
and then I went back to Bangkok, and then I went to Calcutta, which I hated,
mm.
and up to Benares and the Ganges, and up to Nepal, and to Delhi and Agra, and then up to Kashmir, and to Afghanistan, and Iran, and Turkey, and then I took a train through Europe to Germany, and you know, flying back from London, but.
And then wound up here.
Well, I lived here at that time. I was 68, so
yeah.
I came back here and I found another apartment. And then I got married in 70. Cambodia really struck me because it was just, to me, Cambodia was Vietnam pre-war. I mean, that's my impression. Well, this is how Vietnam would be,
mm-hmm.
Should be. It's just, you know, peaceful and calm. And, you know, kind of place I think I'd like to stay for a much longer time period. And that's how I felt that night before the Tet Offensive. It was just, this is the way Vietnam should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I asked you about Malacca because my late wife is from there.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. So, it's nice colonial, but not colonial city.
I just remember going, only thing I remember about Malacca was old Portuguese
mm-hmm.
church.
Battlements and such.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how would you, now you've got two experiences, the Peace Corps experience, which is much greater,
uh-huh.
and IVS experience. So perhaps you'd want to talk about them as a whole rather than as two different parts, but you know, however you'd want to.
Well, I think
affecting your.
I think Ethiopia told me more about myself,
mm-hmm.
and Vietnam told me more about the world.
Ooh.
I was 22 years old when I arrived in Ethiopia.
Uh-huh.
And, I didn't know much about Africa, and certainly less about Ethiopia when I arrived there. So,
yeah.
So I was very struck, you know, about everything, the physical beauty of the country, and you know, I liked the people, and the historical background of it, and the proudness and pride of the Africans in Ethiopia. And so I learned a lot about myself as being, you know, African descent,
mm-hmm.
in that context there. And certainly I learned a lot about myself because I was on my own really for the first time.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
Make a lot of decisions, you know,
mm-hmm.
22, 23 year old, make a lot of decisions.
Much more than being a college
student.
Yeah,
you make mistakes and you get lucky sometimes, mistakes don't catch up to you, but you make mistakes and judgment. But I learned a lot about cross-cultural experiences and the way I needed to react to them. And
mm-hmm.
like someone holds your hand, a man's holding your hand, you know what to do.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And then you learn that.
He's grabbing your knee while talking to you or something
and
like
you
that.
You learn that that's how men behave in,
yeah.
in those societies because, you know, men are very affectionate with men, so
yeah.
It doesn't mean anything sexual, but
mm-hmm.
you learn how to react to it and how to make
yeah.
judgments about value systems.
The hair would always get back up here, though.
Yeah, well, the first time it happened to me was I was only in the country about a month, and someone who I met previously, and there you shake hands. You may see someone 10 times a day, and you shake hands, and you kiss on the cheek. And I've seen the French movies, I knew the kiss on the cheek was okay. And the guy said, like, where are you going? I said, I'm going down to the post office. Okay, I'll walk with you. He walked right down the middle of the street because there's no traffic.
Yeah.
And we were shaking hands, and then started walking, and I'm saying to myself, like, he's not letting go of my hand. We walked like that way for about a block. You know, only thing I could think of was start coughing so I could say, excuse me, cover my mouth and put my hand in a pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
But then after a while, I began to realize it didn't mean anything. So by the time I left the country, I was like, you know,
yeah,
walking down the street, swinging arms, swinging hands. It didn't mean anything. Like, and
it meant friendship.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't mean anything sexually.
Yeah,
know, and,
yeah.
And it's always a big laugh when I talk to my students about this.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk about experience of people who migrate and sometimes have culture shock and how
yeah.
you react to different cultures and always give that. I say, come up here, John, or what his kid's name is,
yeah.
and grab his hand. And I say, why are you blushing?
Yeah. Well, yeah, American kids are really homophobic.
Yeah.
They really
yeah.
are.
Yeah, so
our cultural space
yeah.
is so limited.
But then I was in Vietnam, I learned a lot about, you know, like politics and the world and sort of, especially with those body counts, I began to realize. And I talked to several military people, you know, beyond just the basic private level. And I remember asking someone, I forgot his rank, but he was involved in patrols, like naval boat patrols in canals.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, could the United States win the war? And he said, no. This is before Tet. He said, my job is to do this, and in 6 months I'll be gone. But he says, we can't win this war. And that told me a lot. And I remember telling some reporter, I don't remember his name, or where he was, who he was affiliated with, but I remember telling him right after the test that the war's over with. And he gave me this kind of quizzical look like, well, who are you to say that, you know? I said, the war's over with. America's lost already. Because I just had a sense of what I experienced, you know, day to day with Vietnamese people, the way they look at the war. And so I learned a lot about the world, you know, geopolitics, being there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, learned to be more of a skeptic, not to accept everything you read in the papers. Because I saw all the lies and stars and stripes and, you know, body counts and saying Canto is safe and Canto got curfew and I can't even go outside and been shot at.
Yeah,
so it's safe, all
right. Yeah, right. Safe for who? Safe for the shooters. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, those kinds of things.
And I think I might have to say that this is pretty good for now.
Okay.
If only because I've got a 12 appointment and I was just looking at the watch.
Where do you have to go?
Let me pause this for a second. Good, we got the subway stuff worked out. But I think we did cover quite a bit, you know, because someone, I interviewed a couple people who were in either Vietnam or Laos for less than a year, and we were lucky to do 1 hour of tape, and we're into this, you know, it's almost down to another half hour, and that's good, and, you know, if you do come across that file when going through the boxes, that'll be a lot more.
There was about 5 letters that I wrote, and then some of this recent correspondence I received from Vietnam that I think would be helpful in terms of how people have adjusted to the communist rule.
Because we are going to try to do a little epilogue stuff on not only the individuals, but some Vietnamese, because there are some former, well, Vietnamese and Laotians who formerly worked with IVS Laos, IVS Vietnam, were in the United States.
Okay.
And we've interviewed, I've interviewed Mr. Chi, who was with some of the early IVS folks as a language instructor and such. And actually married a volunteer, Diana, I forget her maiden name, but Diana Bowie now. And let's see, Nguyen, what's her name? Hung Qua? No, it's wrong. Anyway, you know, and some other folks. Because we want more than just the American picture on these things, because, you know, it's only half the dynamic. And so I think I'll just end it and say thank you very much.
Okay, Paul.
All right.